It's Tuesday, March 3rd, and welcome to Higher IQ. A few weeks ago, a Pikachu Pokemon card sold for about $16.5 million, which is more than the previous world record for a trading card, a signed collectible featuring Michael Jordan and Kobe Bryant, which sold for just under $13 million last summer. February 27th last week marked 30 years since Pokemon first launched in Japan on a chunky gray Game Boy. What began as a modest role-playing game about collecting creatures is now the highest-grossing media franchise in history, with lifetime revenues estimated around $100 billion. So today isn't just a nostalgia trip, it's a case study in how cultural value compounds, how a children's game becomes an economic engine, and what that teaches us about scarcity, identity, and markets. When Pokemon Red and Green launched in February 1996, the Game Boy was already 7 years old. In hardware terms, it was ancient. Nintendo was not unveiling the future. They were stretching the past. The game itself was simple. Explore towns, capture creatures, train them, battle other trainers. But the design choice that changed everything was this. You could not collect them all alone. There were two versions. Each contained exclusive Pokemon. If you wanted a complete collection, you needed someone else. You connected your device to theirs with a link cable and traded. Completion required connection. Think about that from a game theory perspective. If everyone bought the same version, nobody won. The optimal strategy was coordination. One person buys red, another buys green. The game literally trained kids to build trading networks. Before online multiplayer was mainstream, Pokemon embedded network effects into a cartridge. The more people who played, the more valuable your own copy became. If two kids had it, that was fun. If 50 kids had it, the ecosystem deepened. Trading became strategic. Rare creatures carried social status. And then there was Mew, the secret 151st Pokemon. Rumors about how to obtain it spread through playgrounds. Most methods were fake. The mystery didn't hurt the brand. It amplified it. Kids weren't just playing a game. They were participating in a shared puzzle. This is the first mechanism to understand. Pokemon monetizes participation. Marvel monetizes spectacle. You sit back and watch. Pokemon monetizes interaction. You trade. You battle. You collect. You compare. When more people watch a movie, your experience doesn't change. When more people play Pokemon, your experience improves. The network gets richer. Strategies evolve. Secondary markets emerge. That is how you move from product to platform. Within a year, the anime launched. Pikachu wasn't just a stat line. It had personality. Emotional attachment deepened. Then came the trading card game. Now the creatures lived in binders and backpacks, physical objects that could be owned, swapped, displayed. Over time, the scale became staggering. Nearly 500 million video game units shipped. More than 75 billion trading cards printed in 16 languages. 75 billion. That's not a fad. That's infrastructure. Most entertainment franchises age alongside their audience. A 10-year-old fan becomes a 20-year-old fan. Eventually, that cohort grows older, and unless new fans replace them, revenue plateaus. Pokemon solved this structurally. Every few years, new games introduce new creatures and a new region. A fresh wave of 8-year-olds experiences Pokemon for the first time. To them, it isn't retro, it's current. At the same time, the original fans from the late 90s are now in their 30s and 40s. Many have disposable income. They aren't buying booster packs for playground battles. They're buying graded vintage cards, limited editions, nostalgia. Pokemon runs two demand curves at once. Children create scale. Adults create scarcity premiums. That dual engine is rare. It means the franchise doesn't depend on a single aging audience. It continuously resets the base while monetizing the top end. Then in 2016, Pokemon Go detonated. Within 2 months, the app hit 500 million downloads. Adults who hadn't played in years suddenly found themselves outside, phones raised, chasing digital monsters. The app generated billions and briefly became a cultural phenomenon again. That moment demonstrated something important. Intellectual property with deep emotional roots can re-explode when technology shifts. Pokemon didn't need new characters, it needed a new interface. The brand had already built social mechanics. Mobile amplified them. Fast forward to this week. The February 2026 Pokemon Presents dropped a 25-minute anniversary stream. The headline, Generation 10 is coming, Pokemon Winds and Waves, due in 2027. But also, Pokemon FireRed and LeafGreen just dropped on Switch today, and Pokemon XD Gale of Darkness is coming to Switch too, the old and the new, releasing simultaneously. Games feed the show feeds the cards feed identity, identity feeds the next generation of games, the system renews itself. Now back to that $16.5 million Pikachu. The Pikachu Illustrator card was originally awarded to winners of a Japanese art contest in the late 90s. Only a handful exist. Designed by Atsuko Nishida, the person who actually created Pikachu, it was never sold in stores. You couldn't buy it. You had to earn it. That origin story matters. It's less a game piece and more a historical artifact. In 2021, Logan Paul acquired a high-grade copy in a trade valued over $5 million. Last week, it sold at auction for roughly $16.5 million, setting a record for a trading card. The headline is dramatic, but the mechanism underneath is more interesting. Collectibles become financial assets when three things happen. First, condition becomes standardized. Grading companies assign numerical scores the market trusts. A near-perfect grade compresses uncertainty into a single signal. Second, price history becomes transparent. Online auction databases let buyers and sellers see comparable sales. You can track appreciation. You can benchmark value. Third, liquidity improves. The easier it is to buy and sell, the more comfortable capital becomes entering the space. When those conditions are met, a toy becomes legible to investors. But we have to be honest here. The Illustrator is a trophy asset. It behaves more like a rare painting than a typical retail pack card. The broader Pokemon card market is massive and diverse. During the 2020 lockdown, nostalgia, stimulus money, and livestream culture collided. Influencers opened vintage boxes on camera. Search interest spiked. Certain first edition cards surged in value. How much? Since 2004, the value of top-tier graded vintage Pokemon cards has increased about 6,000%. The S&P 500 over that same period, about 500%. Cardboard has outperformed stocks by more than 10 to 1 if you bought the right cards and kept them pristine. That's an important caveat. That figure reflects a small slice of top-graded vintage cards, not the average binder in a closet. Most cards printed today will never do this, but the slice that does tells us something. Some of those pandemic prices have since cooled. Meanwhile, the company prints billions of new cards annually. Modern supply is enormous. Most cards are affordable. Most will not appreciate dramatically. So why does the top end explode? Because scarcity in Pokemon is engineered. The company prints billions of cards but inserts ultra-rare chase cards into each set. Special art, limited promos, low pull rates. Scarcity exists inside abundance. It's similar to luxury fashion. Wide distribution, narrow rarity. Add in generational nostalgia and a constantly refreshed fan base, and you have a collector ecosystem that doesn't dry up. The early cards are scarce, partly because kids treated them like toys. Pristine copies from 1999 are rare, precisely because they were played with. That accidental scarcity becomes powerful decades later when adult collectors with income compete for high-grade survivors. Not because cardboard is magical, because supply was destroyed by childhood and demand was preserved by memory. 30 years ago, Pokemon asked kids to connect two Game Boys so they could trade and complete a collection. That small design decision turned a game into a network. Three decades later, that network supports 75 billion cards, nearly half a billion games sold, and a Pikachu card worth more than $16 million. The franchises that endure aren't the ones that just stay popular. They're the ones that design for participation. Pokemon didn't sell characters, it sold connection, and connection compounds. Stay curious, and we'll see you tomorrow.